Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Biography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today, I'm speaking with Anthony Badger about his book, Albert Gore Sr., A Political Life. Tony, welcome to the New Books Network.
It's a pleasure to be here, Mark.
It's a pleasure to have you on our podcast. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Well, I'm British, and I grew up in the late 1950s, early 1960s, went to university in the 1960s. And wanted to do American history as a graduate study because when I was growing up in Bristol in England, my father had a book on his shelves called America Came My Way, which was a book written by an English baronet in the 1930s who did a sort of grand tour of the United States, starting with Walter Winchell in New York and ending up with Shirley Temple in Hollywood. And he had a series of introductions. I always remember one chapter, and that chapter was called Huey Long Takes His Shirt Off, which was an interview with the senator from Louisiana, based on an interview with the senator from Louisiana in 1935. What struck in my mind as a 12-year-old reading that in Britain was a little asterisk about next to the chapter heading, which pointed out that, of course, this interview took place before Senator Long was assassinated. 1959, people didn't get assassinated in the way that they did later. And that always stuck in my mind. And when I was a student in Cambridge in the mid-1960s, I was going to do an American history course. Bill Luxenburg's book on the New Deal had just come out. And I read this as my first serious book in American history and then discovered this man, Huey Long, who I'd stayed in my mind, was actually an important figure. And I got very interested in that sort of colorful Southern politics, which seemed so much more interesting than rather gray British politics. And it was true. It was clear that that was a feeling many Britons had in the 1930s when they were making that comparison. And it remained true to the present day.
Background in the politics of the American South, I think, is really infuses your book. It's because you talk about this figure, Albert Gore Sr., in that context of what was going on in the region, in the country, in that post-war period. What was it that led you to focus upon Albert Gore Sr. for a biography?
Well, in the first instance, I was a New Deal historian who happened to be studying the South. I wrote a book on the tobacco program of the New Deal in North Carolina in the 1930s. But then I was teaching the South, and students were getting very much more interested in what I was saying about the 20th century South and about civil rights than they were in the general background or in what I was saying about the New Deal. So what I was looking for was a topic that would combine my interest in the New Deal South and race relations in the later period. And so I became interested in what happened to all those young Southerners. Roosevelt described them as a new generation of Southerners who were growing up in the South. And he had confidence that they would produce a different type of Southern leadership than had been provided by the more conservative Southerners traditionally. And I wanted to know what those Southern liberal New Dealers, some of whom I'd studied in my book on tobacco, what would they do after the war when race would come to the center of their interests? Because in the 1930s, a New Deal Southern liberal could basically ignore the issue of race. Segregation wasn't under challenge. The New Deal wasn't directly challenging disfranchisement or segregation. And so it was easy to combine a faith in the federal government and a faith in what the South was, Roosevelt was doing, what the New Deal was doing, combine that with staying in the Democratic Party. And so when I was looking around for a topic, I got interested in the Southern Manifesto of 1956, that blast of defiance at the Supreme Court. And in particular, how does liberals who had been, who were in the Senate and in the House, how did they cope with that, what they had to do, whether they were going to sign this blast of defiance or whether they were going to apparently defy their constituents. And so I got interested in the three Southern senators who didn't sign the Southern Manifesto: Lyndon Johnson, Albert Gore, and Estes Kefauver. And it happened that a number of the signers in the House, the people who didn't sign, rather, in the House, were people I'd been familiar with in the 1930s in North Carolina. So it was that was what I was interested in, the Southern Manifesto. So I got interested in Albert Gore, and I happened to be in Tennessee in 1990, and I went to look at the Albert Gore papers at Murfreesboro. And I was traveling back to England from there, and the archivist very kindly said, well, why don't you call in on the Gores? And I thought, well, they won't want to see me. And he said, well, they will. So I rang, he rang the Gores for me, and I was put on to Pauline Gore, Albert's wife. Albert was out, she said, but he will want to see you. So I followed that instruction and then drove to the Gore's house in Carthage and met both Pauline and Albert. And so I became particularly interested in Albert, but still wasn't going to write a biography of him. I was focused very much on the Southern Manifesto. And then in 2000, I was asked whether I would consider writing a biography of Albert Gore, because the Middle Tennessee State University had received a challenge grant to fund such a biography. And I said I would be interested. And then I didn't hear anything more for a year. Well, there was a reason for that, because the choice of biographer had to be at least run past the vice president. And as you will remember, Vice President Gore was rather busy in 2000. And so when he was just about to leave office, actually, his office signed off on the biography. And so that's how I came to do two things which I hadn't anticipated. I hadn't anticipated writing a biography, first of all, because I was rather skeptical about the value of biographies. And secondly, I was not anticipating writing a biography of Albert Gore. And I was very pleased and privileged that I got the chance to do that.
It's a very interesting book from a variety of perspectives, and one of the ones is the one that you've just described, which is Albert Gore's position on race, and that's something that I'd like to return to in a bit. But I was wondering if you could start us off by telling us something about who Albert Gore was and what were his origins, what was his family like, and what were his early years like?
Well, he came from a very isolated rural part of Tennessee in the hill country, and grew up on a small subsistence farm. And one of the things that I think I became more and more aware of and became more and more aware of the importance of was that he was like a whole generation of important United States politicians who grew up in what was essentially the horse and buggy age. They went on in time. I mean, you can go around the Senate of the 1950s and 60s, and find people who grew up between 1890 and 1910. In rural small town areas in the South and the West, as I said, in this very often very isolated, if you like, backward parts of the country, and yet they went on to lead America into fighting in World War II, leading it to the position of a global superpower, controlling atomic energy, sorting out modern aviation, sorting out a road system for the United States, bring America into very much into the 21st century and into the role it has today. And I just thought it was interesting how the people like Gore moved from that very parochial background to such a position of prominence. As an ambitious young man, very anxious to sort, as it were, get on and get out of the isolated hill country, he went to university, but not to the prestigious University of Tennessee, but to basically a teacher training college. And he worked, rather than like Lyndon Johnson, he worked his way through college. He would do a semester at Murfreesboro and then go home, either grow tobacco or work as a salesman, and then go back and complete his degree. He got the chance to be the county superintendent for education, and he was progressive reforming education administrator at a time when there were powerful modernizing forces in the Tennessee school system. So he began to establish something of a local political reputation. He was taken up by some state politicians. He was made by Gordon Browning, made him commissioner of labor. And then suddenly a vacancy occurred in Congress, in his home district. And so he ran for office. And one has to remember that he ran for office at a time when this was very much patronage-oriented politics within a one-party democratic system. That is, there were, in that primary election, there were a lot of candidates, most of whom it was very difficult to establish any clear policy differences between them. And somehow you had to stand out. Now, Gore was a great stump speaker. Tom Wicker used to say that the New York Times journalist used to say that he was the best stump speaker that he'd ever heard. But even a stump speaker didn't necessarily attract people's attention. And as he campaigned right through his district, campaigning every day in little small crossroads across all the counties in a very large district, he needed some way to attract a crowd. How do you attract a crowd? Well, he was a fiddler. And so he had a group of country musicians who went with him. And during his campaign stops, he would pull out his fiddle and entertain the crowd. With all his local connections, that's how he got elected to Congress.
It's interesting reading your description of Gore as a politician, because you describe that he has these many strengths, such as you just mentioned, his stump speaking. You describe him as being, you know, very intellectual, very dedicated. But you also mention that in many ways, the true repository of genuine political skill in the household is his wife, Pauline. I was wondering if you could explain a bit about, you know, his marriage to her and how she helped to shape and develop his political career, especially early on.
Well, I mean, they met because Albert was attempting to be to train as a lawyer while he was also being the commissioner of education for Smith County. And he would travel up. He went to law school, a night law school in Nashville, and he would drive up. And it was a fair drive in those days across the sorts of two-way roads that they had in Tennessee in the 1930s. He would get up to Nashville. He would do his classes, and then before going home, he would go into the local YMCA and get a cup of coffee. And he got to know the waitress there, and the waitress was also working her way through law school, but this time Vanderbilt Law School. And Pauline Gore was one of the first women to graduate in law from Vanderbilt, and she never really got the chance to practice law. She did initially in Arkansas, and then later on, briefly after Albert was defeated, they practiced together in Washington. But there was no doubting her intellectual pedigree and her intellectual ability. But she was also a natural politician. She knew if you went into a room, it was Pauline who knew everybody in the room and would guide Albert to the right people, who always remembered the names, who had this encyclopedic knowledge of local contacts. And it used to be said in Tennessee that in the Gore family, That is, the two natural politicians were Pauline Gore and her daughter, Nancy. And the they were much more natural politicians than the two politicians, that is, Albert and Al. And so Pauline was very, they were always a team, political team. She would stand in for him on the campaign trail. She was heavily involved in Washington, in studying policy and networking. And she also was a fair, she used to say that she was much more hard-headed than Albert, and that she tried to present, she said he got much further with my practical advice than he did on his high-fluting oratory. And he was also, you know, I tried to persuade him, not always successfully, she said, to avoid butting his head against a stone in a futile cause. Well, Albert got into a few of those, but on the whole, it was Pauline who was persuading him all the time to be more realistic. Al remembers what a privilege it was to grow up in Washington in the 1950s and 1960s, and every morning at breakfast, listen to two, as he said, two of the best political operators in Washington discuss current policy and the and current politics.
So, as you describe, Albert Gore gets elected to the House of Representatives in 1938, and he ends up serving in the House for 14 years. What was that service like, and how is he regarded by his peers, and what did he accomplish during that time?
Well, he was always regarded from the, I think from a very early point, he was taken under his wing, partly by Sam Rayburn, the Speaker, the legendary eventually Speaker of the House, Democratic Speaker of the House. And he went to Washington alongside Wilbur Mills, later the powerful Ways and Means Chairman, and Mike Mulroney, later Senator from Oklahoma. And they were clearly seen as three coming young men. He often was quite independent in his early days, and he was often quite conservative in his time in Washington. But he was a devoted follower of Cordell Hull, who by then was Secretary of State, and he came from Carthage, Tennessee, and Albert, that was Albert's home as well. And so he was picked out by the administration, basically, to be a supporter of the interventionist policies of the Roosevelt administration in the lead up to war, and whether that was on repeal of the Neutrality Acts or on Lend-Lease, Albert became a spokesman for interventionism, and he learned. I think the thing I'd say about his time in Washington as a congressman was that he learned and developed. I mean, he learned by his battles in World War II on behalf of price controls, price and wage controls, in which he was aligned with, on the one hand, people like John Kenneth Galbraith in the Office of Price Administration, and on the other hand, wise old timers like Bernard Baruch. He studied up the subject and became a leading spokesman for a more comprehensive price and control regime to combat inflation. But he became a real internationalist in terms of developing a post-war international organization. He became one of the main spokesmen for the United Nations. And he learned very much about atomic energy because he was intimately involved with the success of the Tennessee Valley Authority. And the Tennessee Valley Authority, and of course, became linked to also to the nuclear facility at Oak Ridge. He became very interested in the whole question of atomic energy, both in terms of how it could be used in war, because in his early days he was really quite enthusiastic for tactical use of nuclear weapons, and he talked about the opportunities from that. And he also, he thought he could break the stalemate in the Korean War by creating a dehumanized, radiated radiological belt across the middle of Korea as a way of ending that sort of meat grinder of a war. But he also saw the potential peaceful use of atomic energy and was very interested in developing that. And later on would be very interested in nuclear testing and the banning of atmospheric nuclear tests.
The rise that you described described that just now. It was not necessarily meteoric, but it was he was definitely an emerging force. And yet in 1952, he undertakes a political decision that is really, in one sense, very, very breathtakingly ambitious and you know, not necessarily one that is guaranteed to succeed, in which he challenges his state's senior senator, Kenneth McKellar. I was wondering if you could perhaps describe a bit about Kenneth McKellar and why challenging him was such a big step for AlbertCorps, and how it was that he succeeded in that challenge, in that election.
Well, McKellar was one of those veteran senators who'd been reelected year after year. He was a close ally of Boss Crump, who was the sort of chief political operator in Tennessee, the boss of Memphis. And McKellar was an old-fashioned patronage politician. He'd been in Washington for years. There were few families in Tennessee who didn't have a family member who owed something to McKellar. And that was his prime calling card as a politician. He had this network of loyalties throughout the state. But he was getting old. And there was a lot of speculation that he wasn't going to run again in 1952. And I think when Gore first considered running for the Senate in 52, I think he thought that McKellar might not be running and that it would be an open seat. But when it became clear that Boss Crump, indeed, himself, Boss Crump was quite keen for McKellar not to run in 1952 because he thought McKellar could be beaten. There were new forces in Tennessee politics that Crump had experienced already in 1948 when Estes Kefauver, another Southern liberal, had been elected to the Senate over the usual conservative candidates. So there was real doubt that McKellar would run, but McKellar was determined to run and resisted all the blandishments from Crump and his allies to stand down. And what Gore did was to simply run an extraordinarily vigorous campaign. He was campaigning for basically 2 years, and he never turned down any opportunity to speak in Tennessee. And his week for about 2 years was virtually going down on a Friday night to Tennessee, speaking all day, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, going back to Washington. And then having weeks where he would spend in the state and he would hit 7 or 8 speaking engagements during the day. And it was simply a massively vigorous campaign against McKellar. And he was promising to reconstruct the infrastructure of Tennessee. He wanted to make Tennessee the nuclear capital of the nation. He was campaigning as an internationalist. He was campaigning as a New Dealer. A New Deal liberal, and in all these areas, he was just making his own case rather than attacking McKellar.
So he undertakes this vigorous campaign. It contrasts with McKellar, who sort of is your very classic pork barrel politician, the man who is known by even the people with senility as the senator, and yet in the end AlbertCorps beats him, and it really is remarkable in how you set that context, is that it really does seem to be this transition point in Tennessee when you're talking about Crump's organization's fading. You describe the new generation of veterans who are who want to do something a bit more less corrupt, less involved in that sort of that old school dealing, and much more about these principles and running for these high ideals. And Gore really does seem to embody that, doesn't he?
Yes, and he's able to steer clear of civil rights, and he manages to avoid being smeared on the red issue, which was always a danger in Southern politics at that time. And as you're rightly to say about a new generation of politics, because at the same time that Gore got elected to the Senate in 52, Frank Clement, representing a rather different set of politics in political organizations. Clement was part of the Crump organization, but he was a young, attractive, again, great speaker, running against incumbent Governor Gordon Browning. So that they really were capturing, as you say, capturing a transition period, a handover to a new generation of politicians. And as I said, before the race issue really started to hot up in Tennessee.
So Gore succeeds in defeating McKellar in the Democratic primary, which, as you know, at that time was tantamount to winning the election. And then he begins what becomes three terms in the United States Senate. I was wondering if you could perhaps describe some of the early issues he addressed and how he really made a very significant legislative mark early on in his career.
Well, I think ultimately, I mean, he's making his mark as an infrastructure politician. I mean, like all sort of Southern liberals from the 1930s, they were what John Sparkman of Alabama described as TVA liberals. They could see what the TVA had done in transforming a region, or potential for the TVA to transform a region, and they really believed that you could, whether it was water resource development, diversified agriculture, new industrial development. This is what could modernize the South. This is what Lyndon Johnson was thinking in Texas. It's what Lister Hill and John Spartan were thinking in Alabama, and it's what Albert Gore was thinking in Tennessee. So Albert Gore was always concerned to defend the TVA, and during the Eisenhower years, there were a number of issues where they really thought that the Eisenhower administration was maybe even trying to privatize the TVA. But certainly restrict its operations. And particularly, there was a big controversy, the so-called Dixon-Yates controversy, about the TVA withdrawing from the production of public cheap electricity for cities like Memphis. And so Gore makes his name in that area. He makes his name on atomic energy because one of the things that he's on the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy, and one of the things that he wants to do is to make sure that the United States fully exploits the peaceful uses of nuclear energy. And he really believes that he looks around the world and he looks at what's happening in Japan and Britain, and he sees their government-sponsored research and development and the development of atomic energy. And he believes that that's what ought to happen in the United States. But the Atomic Energy Commission under the Eisenhower administration was determined not to go down that route. Gore manages to get a bill passed Congress in 1956 with Lyndon Johnson's help, pass a Senate at least, for the public development of atomic energy and public construction of nuclear reactors. But it doesn't get any further than that. But the real contribution he makes, of course, is in his sponsorship of the interstate highway system, which is, in a sense, really the last great New Deal infrastructure measure, a public works measure. It's something that Roosevelt would have loved to have got in the 1940s, in particular, during the war. It's what he had ambitions to see. The road system was in great crisis in the United States in the 1940s and 1950s. And the combination of Gore on the one hand and wanting to see a road system, modernized road system in the South, and Eisenhower who wanted to see a modernized road system for economic prosperity and for national civil defense, Gore becomes the Senate sponsor of the Interstate Highway Act of 1956. And Al Gore always remembers that pointed out to me that how important an interstate highway system was to a state in the long run, to a state like Nashville, to a state like Tennessee. If you looked at Nashville, the state capital, and you see the intersection of these major interstates, national interstates, and Nashville becomes, in a sense, a commercial hub for the nation. It's no coincidence that, you know, FedEx has its major headquarters in Tennessee. So many car plants begin to locate in that area around Nashville. It has a transformative effect on the South, as indeed, of course, it has on the nation. But that's what I think I would associate Gore most with during those early years in the Senate.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And it's also interesting, and this was something of a revelation for me reading your book, was that how his stature was such that he was a plausible contender for the vice presidency back in 1956.
Yeah, they used to say in Tennessee that every man in America can run for the president, and in Tennessee they all are, because Tennessee had three candidates for the vice presidency in 1956: Estes Kefauver, who had been defeated by Stevenson for the presidential bid; Frank Clement, the governor; and Albert Gore. Frank Clement was the keynoter at the 1956 Chicago convention. And at that convention, Stevenson opened up the vice presidential nomination to the floor. He didn't choose a vice president. And then you have this, for a moment, Albert Gore, I think, really thought he had a chance of getting the vice presidency. And in the end, he had to concede that if he allowed John Kennedy to win the vice presidency in 1956, Kennedy was one of the other candidates. And as a result, Estes Kefauver was defeated. He would face real political retribution in Tennessee. So in the end, Gore released his forces to support Kefauver, and that put Kefauver, it took the victory away from Kennedy and put Kefauver in the vice presidential nominee's seat.
It's interesting say in your book that that's pretty much the closest that Albert Gore ever got to being president. But you also describe how in 1960, when he's having a meal with his family, and Robert Novak is a guest, and he sort of blurts out to Novak during this lunch that they're having that, you know, what has Kennedy got that I haven't got? As you can tell, is kind of praying in the back of his mind for years afterward, this idea that maybe he could be president too. Of course, that said of so many senators, though.
Well, it said of so many senators, and Gore is fairly self-deprecating about how he, you know, he got the bug, but he knew he didn't have a chance in 1960, and he brought all the major candidates to Tennessee, and he liked Kennedy. But he bought all of it, you know. But when he looked around, and of course, they were all senators, though, and it was Kennedy and Symington and Lyndon Johnson. I think he rightly thought that, well, they don't have anything that I don't have. But he was realistic, and he was a good friend of Kennedy's, and remained so. So he wasn't disappointed in 1960. But I think there's no doubt in my mind that in the long run, he still maintained some hope that he might still be the first Southern president, because Kennedy was going to serve two terms. Lyndon Johnson was neutralized once he became vice president. And in 1968, you know, who knows, the first Southern senator could be Albert Gore. Well, of course, there was an assassination and there was Lyndon Johnson. And that ended any hope that Gore ever had of becoming president of the United States.
It's also during this period as well when Gore is beginning to confront more directly the issue of civil rights. And your examination of it is really fascinating, because you're describing, you mentioned already the Southern Manifesto and how Gore is one of the three senators in 1957 to sign it. And I've read in a few accounts of the period about how this was a testament to Gore's liberalism. And yet what you described is a much more nuanced position, one that had to take into consideration the fact that Tennessee was not a liberal bastion in the South in the 1950s and 1960s, and how Gore's position as well, which was, as you explained, is a sincere one, is one that nonetheless, you know, reflects as well a sense of how he was not necessarily a committed civil rights activist in the way that we might think of somebody like, say, Hubert Humphrey.
And so, certainly not. And he was not as by any means as publicly committed and identified with civil rights as Estes Kefauver, his fellow senator, was. I mean, Kefauver had run for national office. Kefauver had to have a liberal stance on civil rights. And I'm sure it was a genuine one. Gore had much less sense of the power of the civil rights issue. What I've tried to say in the book is that one of the reasons for that is that Gore got African Americans were voting in Tennessee by the mid-1950s in sizable numbers. 25% of the black voting age population was registered to vote, and Gore would have got their support in 1952, as Kefauver did throughout his political career. But you campaigned for the black vote at a distance. You know, you campaigned through intermediaries. You didn't necessarily go into the black community and campaign directly. You had black leaders in the black community, sometimes called racial diplomats, who you would deal with, and they would satisfy themselves that you were a liberal on this issue and would deliver the African-American vote. The result of that is that Gore did take courageous stands on civil rights as a matter of principle, a sense of fairness. He was particularly keen on the right of African Americans to vote. He regarded that if African Americans could give their lives to the country, they should be able to vote. But he was shielded from what I've said in the book is he's shielded from the impatience of African Americans. He was a gradualist. He had no great desire to throw off the shackles of segregation as such. He just anticipated, like so many Southern liberals did, gradual racial change as a result of economic modernization. And so in the 1960s, that would be a much harder balancing act to pursue, because by then whites were no longer dictating the timetable of racial change. Most of the controversies over civil rights in the South in the 1950s were controversies within the white community about what the white community should do about school court-ordered school desegregation. They were not responding necessarily to African-American protest. When African-Americans protest directly in the 1960s, it's a different ballgame.
You also described relationship to the various legislation about how in 1957, with Lyndon Johnson's majority leader, Gore is able to take certain votes and positions that allow him, when he's running for re-election the following year, to prevent sort of a nuanced opinion that doesn't confront African Americans directly. By 1964, you're talking about the Civil Rights Act of 64. Following year, you had the Voting Rights Act, and it becomes it's no longer as easy to develop that nuance, especially as the two sides are getting polarized.
Yeah. In 57 and 1960, where the two Civil Rights Acts of 57 and 1960 are both both guided through by Johnson in the Senate, Gore knew that there were going to be compromises to prevent Southern filibustering. And so he could sort of bask behind the sorts of compromises that were made and defend his votes in Tennessee on the grounds that he was voting for something that was a lot less coercive than the original demands. In 1964, when Kennedy introduced civil rights legislation in 63, I think Gore thought the same process might occur, that he would be able to see the bill softened, and as a result, he would be able to go back home and say, well, we softened the bill, and therefore I was able to vote for it. As soon as Johnson became president, in the circumstances that he did, and Johnson knowing that he had to get full scale, he had to commit himself absolutely to the Civil Rights Act in 64. There were no compromises. He couldn't afford to compromise for two reasons. He couldn't afford to compromise because he had to appear as a liberal to win over the liberals in the Democratic Party, who had been suspicious of him. But he also had to, he knew that the Republicans, who'd been burnt before when dealing with Lyndon Johnson on civil rights, he needed their support, and he needed to persuade the Southerners that he was going to go for it all. As a result, there was no need to soften the bill, and there was no need to make the sorts of gestures that Albert Gore would have been able to get behind. And so in the end, I don't think we fully articulated why Gore voted against the 64 Act. Other Southern moderates made the same sort of move. They voted, they hadn't signed the Southern Manifesto. They voted for 57 and 60. They voted against 64, but they would come round 65 to support the Voting Rights Act.
That decision, though, to vote for the Voting Rights Act, Gore's position becomes much more starkly apparent and alienates some of his constituents. But as you describe, he then also has, soon on top of that, another issue which really turns a lot of his constituents against him, which is Vietnam. I was wondering if you could perhaps go a bit into Gore's role in foreign policy generally in the Senate, and before delving a bit more deeply into Vietnam, and how Gore really emerges as a prominent spokesperson against the war.
Gore was a committed internationalist, and he was a committed Cold Warrior, and he was a committed supporter of containment, indeed of global containment. So all of those things, put him in the line in which one line from that would be to support the policy in Vietnam. But Gore had reasons to doubt it. First of all, in Korea, he had been very alarmed by the prospect of this sort of eternal war of attrition in Korea, which he regarded as futile when you had the Chinese on the other side. He got alarmed at the prospect of the United States getting involved in Vietnam in 1954 when the French requested assistance. And he was part of the team advising Johnson to make sure that the United States didn't get committed in 1954. But he went to Vietnam in 1959 as a mission with Gail McGee of Wyoming for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, ostensibly to look at the operation of the aid program in Vietnam. And he came away pretty convinced that the Diem regime was an increasingly authoritarian regime and was not popular. And if you add into that the sorts of reports that were coming out of Vietnam in the early 1960s from David Halberstam, the New York Times correspondent, who was piercing the sort of propaganda that was being put out by the military and the government about the success of American advisors in the counterinsurgency war in Vietnam. Clearly, Gore's own experience in Vietnam, the fact that he knew Halberstam, been a reporter on the Tennessean, he trusted what Halberstam was saying. All of these things made him deeply skeptical about getting involved in Vietnam. As a result, in August 1963, he went to see Kennedy and he advised Kennedy that he should withdraw from Vietnam. Kennedy wasn't in a position to take that advice in 63, but Gore always believed that if Kennedy had been had survived and been elected in re-elected in 64, that Gore would have withdrawn, that Kennedy would have withdrawn from Vietnam. So Gore was deeply skeptical about Vietnam from the start. He did have, however, like almost everybody else in the Senate, support the Tonkin Gulf Resolution in the summer of 1964, where Lyndon Johnson got his sort of mandate from the Senate for retaliatory military action in Vietnam. And he said, when I talked to him in 1990, whenever you went to see Johnson, Johnson would pull the Tonkin Gulf Resolution out of his pocket and say, "You guys voted for this." And try and disarm their criticism that way. But Gore in 1964 was prepared to support Tonkin Gulf, partly because he was up for re-election in Tennessee, and partly because of the strength of Goldwater in the South and in Tennessee, and partly because he genuinely regarded, and for a long time, actually, 64, good part of 65 as well, he regarded Johnson as a force for restraint against the military. Gore was deeply suspicious that the military were really pushing for a purely military solution in Vietnam and victory. And he didn't believe that was possible. But he saw Johnson as indeed Johnson was in many ways, a force for restraint in that early period. In December 64, Gore is already calling for a negotiated settlement. And really from then on, he is a very public skeptic about the Vietnam War. And of course, from the televised hearings in the start of 1966, he's very much in lockstep with Fulbright on the war and opposition to it.
And politically, that's very courageous on a number of levels, because for one thing, he's facing the ire of the President of the United States. He is taking a position that is very much one at odds with many of his constituents. And I love the material that you quote, and you have a photograph of an endorsement letter from a union, and the union member is just, venting on the page about how he's not going to vote for Gore because of this. And he doesn't have that advantage that Fulbright had of having been, a supporter of segregation, and therefore didn't have to worry about having already, soured the voters of his state upon him. So he's taking a stance that he knows is going to really be politically problematic, and gets more so as it goes along. And yet he never really wavers from it after 65.
No, and of course he becomes increasingly, you get this disconnect. He becomes increasingly popular in the North and amongst Northern liberals. His reputation nationally gets higher and higher, particularly during the early years of the Nixon administration. And at the same time, he is in real political trouble at home, a very isolated figure in the state. And he had never really developed his own political organization. And that will come back to haunt him in the late 1970s. What's happening is that he's got a worldview by the late. Well, he has a worldview that is increasingly at odds with that of his constituents. The issue that really brings it home is when Nixon nominates two Southerners to the Supreme Court as part of his Southern strategy, and he nominates two strict constructionists to the Supreme Court, Clement Haynsworth and Harold Carswell. And Gore is really put on the spot on those votes. Gore, on the one hand, is a believer in the president having the right to nominate people who he wants to major offices. But he becomes increasingly, it's under a lot of pressure from Northern liberals and Ted Kennedy and Birch Bayh and people like that to fight against Haynsworth. In particular, and Gore is really Gore keeps his hands, his cards very close to his chest. No one really knows until the last minute which way he's going to go on that vote. And he votes against Haynsworth's nomination, and then later he votes against Carswell's nomination. Ted Kennedy told me that he thought they were two of the really great courageous acts of a senator, and that confirmed to many in the state that he was listening far too much to the forces of the Eastern liberal establishment and not enough to people in Tennessee. And because those issues that were now getting wrapped up, not merely the question of civil rights and Vietnam, but of course with the Supreme Court, you were thinking about law and order, and you were thinking about prayer in the schools and other decisions that the Supreme Court had taken in the 1960s. So the question, the battle for the Supreme Court, had a weight in Tennessee that it has in many parts of the nation today.
So how does all this catalyze in 1970 to result in Albert Gore's defeat? Who runs against him, and how is all of this exploited to turn out Albert Gore?
Well, he's opposed. And one must always remember that Republicanism in Tennessee was steadily growing in strength throughout the 1950s and 1960s. There had always been a strong, a minority, but strong Republican presence in the state through the sort of, as we were, the Mountain Republicans of Eastern Tennessee. And there'd always been two and sometimes three Republican congressmen in the eastern part of the state. But in the 1960s, those are joined by many migrants to the state, by young businessmen who, and sometimes young servicemen coming back and thinking that the old style courthouse politics, the Democrats, is something that really ought to be cast over. And then by the ideological thrust of the business conservatism of people like Barry Goldwater and the Republican Party. And the standard bearer for the party in that way, Howard Baker, in 1966 had been elected to the Senate as a Republican, but he represented very much the sort of moderate Republicanism of Eastern Tennessee. William Brock in 1970 was a pro-Nixon congressman, very pro-Goldwater, strong conservative. He was mounting a very well-financed campaign supported by the Nixon administration and hammering away on these new issues, hammering away on busing, that is the forced busing of school children to implement school desegregation, hammering away on gun control, hammering away on the war, hammering away on the Supreme Court nominations. And these issues, these were issues in which it was possible to see Gore standing on one side and a large number of Tennessee voters standing on the other. Said something of a different worldview about the role of the federal government and about the role of traditional forms of race relations.
It's in many ways, I found reading that section of your book a very, it's almost a precursor to so many of the elections that are going to follow in the South and in the country in the 1970s, 1980s, 1990s, down to the present day. And yet, I also found it was remarkable that, given where Gore was by 1970, given what was arrayed against him, that he ended up doing as well as he did in the end.
Well, yes, and of course he ran a disorganized but extremely active campaign. Once he finally sort of freed himself from Washington and came back to the state and campaigned vigorously, which he was a great campaigner in the old fashioned way. And of course, in 1970 he had he had some very well crafted TV ads. Produced by the filmmaker who created films, campaign films for the Kennedys. So he had that going for him. He had a lot of traditional Democratic support, and he had the African-American support was now pretty wholehearted, whereas it had been equivocal back in 1964. So he had that going for it. And of course, Tennessee was still a Democratic state in terms of state legislature. So lots of local politicians who might have not been all that happy with Gore were nevertheless, were going to vote the Democratic ticket. But it was a formidable race. It was the injection of prayer in the school late in the campaign, school prayer as an issue, which really, I think, took Gore by surprise. And I was very struck by this way. The campaign against Ralph Yarborough in Texas earlier in that year, and then against Gore in 1970, were issues where school prayer was for the first time successfully in Senate elections was used as an issue. And for people of Gore's generation, religion, and this is where it's so different from today, for people of Gore's generation, religion was really a private affair. I mean, Gore was a Baptist strict believer in church and state. He wasn't terribly. He wasn't publicly religious in any particular way. And there, as one scholar said once, there's been a sort of religious truce in the United States from Al Smith's campaign in 1928, where the Catholic issue was so prominent, to the 1970s. There was sort of, public religiosity was not what the nation was about and what politics was not about. School prayer put religion straight back right in the center. And I think Gore found that a very difficult issue to deal with. Is one that almost came to him from left field, and he found it very difficult to. And certainly, people in the Gore campaign felt that they could feel on the phones and at the doorstep, they could feel the issue floating away from them in the later stage when school prayer got injected into the to the campaign with the slogan that Albert Gore had voted against prayer in the school three times, was the slogan that Brock and his campaign team were using. I should say that Brock himself, when I was talking to him, was never in any doubt that he was going to win in 1970.
So you have Albert Gore, who is, you know, turned out of office in many ways at the height of his powers. He has this national profile. What does he then do with the rest of his life, publicly speaking? Does he try to mount a career back into politics, or does he redirect his energies?
Well, he redirects his energies in two ways, I think. I mean, the first is in he makes money. Gore was a populist, but Gore was also, populists were never anti-capitalist. And Gore was, in a sense, something of a restless entrepreneur. He'd always had a cattle feed business in Tennessee. He'd always purebred cattle. That had led him to links with Arm & Hammer of Occidental. So Albert Gore, like so many people in Washington, sets up as a lawyer. So many defeated Senate candidates sets up as a lawyer in Washington, and soon becomes one of his clients becomes Arm & Hammer and the Island Creek Coal Company. And Gore finds himself very soon as chairman of that company, he becomes for many years the executive chairman of Island Creek, and then the sort of honorary chairman and president. He makes no bones about the fact that he makes the money then that he had never been able to make while he was a senator. He orientates his energies, in a sense, into that business. And when I talked to him in 1990, actually, he was very happy to talk about civil rights and talk about Vietnam and all those sorts of issues. But he was also very keen to talk about negotiating one-to-one with the Chinese leadership and with Ceausescu in Romania about contracts for Island Creek. So he took to that with a vengeance. The second way, of course, that he spent his time, in a sense, or dedicated his energies, was in support of his son, who, of course, got elected to Congress in 1976 from Gore's old House seat, and then later to the Senate, and then campaigning for the presidency in 1988 and for the vice presidency in 1992. Gore wasn't very much involved in Albert Al's first campaign in 1976. In fact, he was kept at a certain arm's length from that campaign. But he was always willing to campaign for Al, And as Pauline said, he used to be in seventh heaven. All you had to do is to send him off to campaign, whether it was for the Senate races or in the presidential campaign in 1988. You'd send him off, and nothing pleased him more. And he had tremendous pride in what Al was doing, even though they had quite significant differences in emphasis and on issues like the environment.
It's interesting to think about the degree to which, as I was reading those pages, about how enthusiastic his father was. You describe how when Al Gore was running for the presidency in 1988, about how you describe how he's getting off the stage and his father goes, you know, this boy is going to be president of the United States. And it's almost as though that the real enthusiasm is much more evident with Albert Gore than it is with his son Al.
Yeah, he has a very different. He's a very vivid campaigner, and as I said in the old style, and he was tireless. He went all around Iowa in 1988 before the Gore campaign decided they didn't really want to go down that route. One of Al's friends remembers him, remembers him being stuck in an airport trying to get back from one of the primary campaigns, while they tried to rest and get some food, Albert went round the whole airport, you know, shaking hands and introducing himself and telling them to the people that they all support Al. So he did have a real enthusiasm, but Al himself was a fine campaigner in his own right.
We've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Yes, I've just given the Huggins lectures, the Nathan Huggins lectures at Harvard on the subject. It's probably the last thing that I shall ever say on Southern liberals and race. And it's called Why White Liberals Fail, Southern Politicians and Race, 1933 to 2018. And that I've got to write that up into a book for Harvard University Press next year. And I have a longstanding commitment to HarperCollins to produce a general book on going back to my older interests on America for their sort of national history series. And I'm taking the years 1920 to 1945. So I have to produce that fairly soon as well.
Well, those both sound like excellent projects, so don't let me hold you up a minute longer. Tony Badger, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you very much indeed, Mark.